Six, session number 27058, Reel 6.
So they find somebody, usually a new pilot, and say, take aircraft J up for a test pilot, about 35, 40 minutes, don't go over certain miles an hour, and check the oil field, the fuel gauge, or whatever it is. Okay, so you do that, which is fairly bloody boring, and you come back and you sign the E77 as the oil gauge is now reading properly. But we had several blokes who had oil gauge trouble. I had airspeed indicator trouble once when the engine just, well, the needle just dropped off completely. You get your airspeed from what's called the pitot tube, which is on the front of the left wing. It sticks out about that far. It's about as thick as a normal hose, and it's got a shape like an arrow. And there's a very small hole in the front, and that's what gives your airspeed reading, the air coming in. And if you've been flying the one aeroplane for some time, you get to hear the sound of the engine and you know what it should sound like if it's doing something. And if it doesn't sound like that, then something is wrong. And you've got to be very alert to try and find out what the hell it is. But, no, we never had any serious troubles that caused any fatalities that were unexplained. But a gremlin was the slang term of the aircraft. Something that bloody well happened that I can't bloody well tell you why, because I don't know.
What about pilots and their... Are pilots suspicious of things?
Oh, superstitious? No, I don't think so. We had one bloke on our squadron who said that if you crossed knives on a table, that was a portent of great disaster. No one else had ever heard of that, but he was the only bloke that I knew who was suspicious. Although, I was going out with a beautiful little Greek girl in Alexandria, and she gave me a huge, beautiful silk, dark green striped silk scarf that made me promise to wear it. She also gave me a little crucifix about that big.
You mentioned the crucifix. You also mentioned that Australians have been seen badly because of actions in the First World War. What specific actions were you talking about?
Well, they did a great deal of damage to certain shops all over the place in Alex and Cairo. I've only heard this from people who have heard it from somebody else. But there may be some degree of justification in that, because when we got to the Middle East, the first thing everybody said to us, if you're going to buy anything from an Arab in a shop, be careful. If the bastard can take you down, he will, for pounds and pounds and pounds. So be very careful. And if some of these Australians went into a shop and thought they were overcharged for something, they would get back on this bloke by getting about 20 of their match and going and trashing the place. And I believe there were several murders around Alex and Cairo at the time, which were attributable to the Australians, rightly or wrongly, I don't know. But a lot of bashings went on, and the troops, if they thought they had been gypped or hadn't been treated fairly, they would take to somebody and cause a great deal of physical damage.
What about being out of control, for instance, drinking-wise?
Oh, I think that happened, certainly, yep. I think quite a number of our blokes would get very, very highly boozed and lose control. But in Alex and Cairo, they had a very heavy load of British MPs, military police, and if they saw anybody playing up or acting out of character or contrary to the rules of discipline, they would grab you, belt you across the head with a bloody big nightstick and cart them off somewhere. And they'd put them in a cell until they sobered up. Could be 2 or 3 days, and then they'd throw them out. Let them go back. But I don't think that was what you'd call endemic in any way. But I think it happened probably a few times here and there. But it may have been caused by an Arab bloke trying to gyp you or steal money from you, because they were past masters of that. And the first thing we were told, if you buy something from an Arab shop, make sure you get the right change and make sure that you're not gypped. And of course, some of them went a bit wild when that happened. But I knew one bloke who's dead now. And he was a Western Australian too. he was carrying around a pistol. And I was in the nightclub with another friend of mine, and we were just sitting there and having a meal, and this bloke turned up, and he was fairly full. And he said he'd been gypped by some female, and apparently he'd been out with a woman, probably a prostitute, I would think, and Alan said she took nearly all of his money. So he fished out of his pocket a small 25 calibre gun about that big, and said, I'm going to shoot the bitch. He said this fairly loudly in this nightclub, and somebody went to the door and said, for Christ's sake, ring the MPs. So as Alan was wandering out with this little gun in his head, the MPs came and clobbered him. And I was sleeping in what's called the Kiwi Clubs, which were a very good organisation. When the 7th and the 9th Divvies were called home, they had an organisation called the ACF, the Australian Comfort Fund, which provided some sort of accommodation. But when the 7th and the 9th Divvies were called back, the ACF vanished too. But the Kiwi Clubs ran a very fine organisation, and we were allowed to use them. You could get a bed there, you could get a very nice meal. One thing that was good, you get a hot shower, because in the desert you never had a shower because there's no water. So you could luxuriate under a shower for 20 minutes, and oh, it was lovely to get all the dust and stuff off. You usually lost about 2 stone in weight. But they were very good, so I went back to the Kiwi Club and went to sleep. And I was woken up about 2 o'clock in the morning by one of the Kiwi Club Maori guards, and he said, there's an MP to see you. And I said, Christ, this hour, what? So I went out, and there were 4 MPs, and they said, are you Sergeant Ulrich? And I said, yes. And they said, may we see your paybook? And one of the rules was you had to carry your paybook, because it showed your rank and all sorts of things about you. So I went back, got a shirt, and fished it out, and they said, oh, will you please come and identify Flying Officer Wagner? He was carrying his pistol. I said, oh, shit, they found him, he's dead. Oh, I'll get out of bed for that 4 or 5 times tonight. So they took me back to a big hall somewhere on the outside of Alexandria. And inside this great hall, there were about 6 or 7 big iron cages that you used to see in old-fashioned zoos for tigers and lions and things. And they had one prisoner, Alan Wagner. And he'd been in a fight, his shirt was torn, his blood streaming down his face, his tie was gone, and he was looking the bloody mess. And they said, is that Alan Wagner? I said, that's him. Can I go now? And they said, oh, yeah. And I said, what about some transport? And they said, transport? A young bloke like you? It's only a mile. Off you go. We'll give you a cup of tea. So they gave me a cup of tea and a biscuit. I had to walk back. But that's the only run-in I had with MPs. But nobody on 3 Squadron ever caused that much of a ruckus. And nobody on 6 Squadron ever caused that much of a ruckus.
Well, you mentioned the Australians on leave. How did they compare to the average Tommy, for instance, on leave, would you say?
Well, the Tommies were probably a little bit jealous of the Australians, because the Australians got a higher rank of pay than an Englishman of the same rank. In Yugoslavia, I was sent over with a detachment of the squadron, which was my responsibility, and I was then an acting flight lieutenant on about 2 guineas a day, and the chap in charge of the Yugoslav Air Force, as they call it, was a fellow called Karl Simic. And he was a colonel, oh no, what do they call it? He was a commissar, which is roughly equivalent to mayoral rank. But he was a pilot officer in the RAF, and he got 8 and 3 pence a day for that sterling. So in general, an Australian of a particular rank was slightly better paid than an Englishman of the same rank, which caused a little bit of rancour here and there. But, that was the way it was. But
what about behaviour-wise?
The Pommies used to get a bit rough, I think, more often than Australians, because a lot of Poms seemed to have a bit of an alcoholic problem when they went on leave. They'd drink rather than eat. And an Englishman who's half full can be a bit of a bloody pest. I think that's why they had so many MPs in Alexandria and Cairo. And anybody who looked like playing it up or wandering around without a cap on or something, they'd grab you, whiz you off to this hall with a bloody animal cage, and that's where you'd stay until they thought you were sober enough to go home or do something else.
What would be the consequences if you were dumped like this?
Well, we had on our squad, and I can tell you in fact, because I was once punished for that, I was going to see my little Greek girlfriend, and I had a dirty shirt. So I bought a new shirt, but didn't have any sergeantship at all. And that didn't worry me. And I was wandering off to wherever he worked in a bookshop, and a couple of his people pulled me up and said, could we see your paper? And of course, you haven't got the right to say no. So I fished it out and I said, well, Sergeant, where are your stripes? I said, oh, burnt my shirt last night, smoking a cigarette, just bought a new one. And they said, bullshit, come with us. So they took me back to their police headquarters. And I said to the bloke behind the desk, gee, I'll bet your mum's proud of you sitting on your bum picking up blokes from the front line area. And he went as red as a bloody boot, but he didn't say anything. But they duly sent a copy to the CO, a fellow called Bobby Gibbs. And he said to me, you're an idiot. You're a bloody idiot. Do a lap of the bloody airfield. Now, this was punishment in a way. You had to put on your parachute and walk around the bloody airfield. Well, there were no clear lines of where the airfield was and where the airfield wasn't. There was a few 44-gallon drums painted white gave you a rough idea where the runway was. So all you did was follow the runway. But rumours and get carried around in the fighter squadron faster than McConey could with his bloody radio set. And before you'd gone too far, somebody would say, hey, Ulrich! And they'd hold up a bottle of something out of a tent. So you'd wander across to their tent and grab the bottle and whatever it was to drink, you'd drink it. And usually before you got all the way around, you were as full as a bloody boot. So you didn't notice the last bit. When you got back, you just took your parachute off, put it where it should be in the flight hut, wandered back to your tent and collapsed on the bed. But that was Gibby's favourite punishment. One, he used to say to us, if you get caught impersonating an officer, it's twice round the bloody airfield. I'm not going to punish you for being impersonating an officer. I'm going to punish you for getting bloody caught, you stupid bastard. So I think I had to do that once, but I know a few other fellows had to do it. But as I say, before you'd gone 100 yards, I only might hold out a bottle. So by the time you were halfway around, you were full. Didn't make any difference.
You mentioned, obviously, prostitutes. How popular were prostitutes in places like Alex?
Well, I think most people were a bit scared because VD was a very, very common occurrence in Alex and Cairo. I don't think there was too much hygiene attached to these females. And there were hundreds of them about, hundreds of them. And three squadron one night, a few bombs were dropped around Alex and one of them hit a brothel. And I think three or four very well-known Australian pilots from three squadron in the brothel, and they were killed. And I believe that the hierarchy for days and days had to try and work out what they were going to put on the death certificate, how these people died. Now, VD was very, very present, and I think if you had unprotected casual sex, you were running a very, very, very high risk, I think.
Presumably you were given medical advice?
Yeah, we had a couple of lessons from the doctor, but they all said the same thing. If you indulge in unprotected sex with somebody you don't know, you're a bloody idiot, and you'll probably get what you bloody deserve. It's called clap. And I've got some tablets for it, but it doesn't do any good, but it's better than nothing. So if you wake up itchy one morning, come and see me. You won't get any bloody sympathy from me, you'll get a few bloody tablets. Got it? Oh, yes, sir. Mm.
Was it just the single blokes that went off to visit these ladies?
I don't know. I suppose it was probably mostly the single blokes, although a few married blokes may have strayed away a bit, but I don't know. Most of the blokes that I knew were too scared. Because if you were sent home with VD, that was the end of your military career. They'd demob you like that. And a lot of us wanted to go home, but they didn't want to be demobbed on receipt because the pay stopped, and very bloody suddenly. So the problem was that if you got VD, you had no excuse. Nothing would be taken as an excuse. If you complained to be too full to know what you're doing, that's your bloody fault. But anyone who was found to have VD generally sent home. Mm. But some of them were very attractive ladies too. But there was always that little ping in the back of the mind that they were probably treading in uncharted waters, and it was a very dear price to pay for a few minutes of enjoyment.
Presumably you were warned against fraternising with the locals, whether they be of that sort of reputation or other. Am I right?
No, I don't think so. No, we were never told that. I got on very well with the Greeks because I was going out with a little Greek girl. When Irene's family first met me, I was very much under the magnifying glass, and they made it quite plain that I was on probation or under examination or under investigation. But once they decided I wasn't going to rape their daughter, I wasn't going to kill everybody inside and steal all the silver, I was made very welcome, very welcome. And I had many meals with them. The Greeks don't celebrate Christmas too much, but they go overboard on New Year. And I was invited by Irene to have New Year's lunch with them. And, they had about 30 people for lunch. It was one of the strangest setups I've ever seen. At each setting place of the table, there was a pile of plates about that high. I think I remember counting 7 plates. And Mrs. Noetakis, who presided over everything, had 2 little crystal bells, each with a different tone. One was a ring for the food waiter, and the other was a ring for the drink waiter. And somebody would come along and put something on the top plate, and you were supposed to eat that. So when you ate that, she'd ring the bell, the food bell, and somebody would come in and take that plate away, and somebody would come in with another spoonful of something and put it on the next plate. And then she'd ring the drink waiter, and they'd come around with a couple of bottles on a trolley and say, what would you like, what would you have, and pour you a glass of wine or a glass of beer or whiskey and soda or something like that. But it was only after I'd taken Irene out about 4 times that I was made welcome. But trying to understand the Greek family psyche is not easy. Not easy at all. Greek families that I know of, and I was told about this later, will give their sons vast sums of money and bid them to go out and sow ye old wild oats never before. But if you look sideways at a little Greek girl, you might wake up in the morning and find your head looking at you from the kitchen table. They were very protective of daughters, very. But once I'd taken Rennie about 4 times, I was made quite welcome. And they gave me a magnificent New Year lunch. I still remember it. The Greeks wait very fine, heady red wine. But I think they've got to get to know you first, I think.
Given the situation in relation to Greece, Crete, what had gone on with the Germans, how did they see allies?
Well, I think they knew, of course, that at El Alamein, and El Alamein is nothing more than a railway station. That's all there is at El Alamein. When I was there, about 6,000 or 7,000 tents, but that was the British Army going forward. And they knew that the Italians and the Germans were only 60 miles away, and they knew that if the Germans got there, their lives wouldn't be worth pursuing. And they were very, very mindful of how deep in the mire they were, and I found them most helpful to the Allies. The Germans had a pay scale which they delivered to all the Arabs, and if an Arab would get a flying officer or a flight lieutenant or something at rank to the Germans as a captive, they'd reward them by giving so many pounds Egyptian. The higher the rank, the higher the pay was. But the British also had one, which was about the same amount of money for rescuing a bloke who was a prisoner of war. But I think really the people in Alex knew that the enemy were only 60 miles away, and that was only half a day's travel. So, as far as I know, they did a lot to help people. And they knew that General Montgomery, who was then the head of the 8th Army, was preparing for a big push westward, and their lives barely hung in the balance, because if Monty was successful, Alex might be saved. If he wasn't successful, heaven only knows what would happen. So I don't know of anyone who was anti-British.
In relation to, you obviously mentioned that you had to rely on one another when you were flying.
Mm-hmm.
How strong did the comradeship become?
Oh, very strong, very strong. Because you knew that bloke just over there, if you got into strife, you might need him to help you out with whatever mishap had befallen on you. And once you knew that you could trust that bloke, the sense of camaraderie was very firm indeed, very firm.
People talk of being a bit concerned they shouldn't become too close to people because they might not be there tomorrow.
Well, that happened once to me, or once or twice to me, in 3 Squadron. We had a bloke called Kenny Goulder, who came from, I think, Sydney. He was a very good singer indeed. And he was shot down and killed one day. And at breakfast the next morning, I looked over and Kenny Goulder wasn't in his seat. And I was just about to say, "Hey, Kenny's late," and I suddenly realised that he was dead. It was just through habit of looking where he used to sit, and there was somebody else there, that just came home to me that he'd been killed. But you do get a bit used to that after a while, because every now and then somebody gets killed. And life goes on, the war goes on, nothing much changes. War is war, and I see nothing pleasant or honourable about war at all. Terrible.
How would you then celebrate, well, celebrate possibly not the right word, but how would you say goodbye to those chaps that weren't there in the morning?
Well, usually there was just the adjutant would say, "Flying officer so-and-so was shot down yesterday afternoon. We've sent out a search party. No sign of him." That was it. And somebody, usually the adjutant, or maybe sometimes the CO and sometimes the flight commander, would have to write to that bloke's parents and just explain that their son or their brother had been killed yesterday, shot down over so-and-so and so-and-so. And while a search party was established, no sign of your son was found.
Would you drink to their health, or...?
No, that's David Niven and stuff, and Stanley Holloway and ancient British propaganda films. No, I mean, if somebody was killed, all of a sudden he wasn't there, and that was it. That's a fact of life. Didn't happen all that much, I don't think. We lost a few blokes, but then so did they. But once the person had gone, what the adjutant would do, he'd detail 2 blokes and say to them, "You go and assemble so-and-so's kit." Now, the reason they did that is that some of the things the blokes had in their personal belongings as souvenirs would have disappointed, to say the least, families at home. Some of the things that some of these blokes bought from, unbelievable. And the idea was anything like that that would be considered offensive or give the wrong impression or make a parent feel in any way distressed was taken out and usually thrown away.
What sort of thing?
Oh, strange things like artificial penises. I think they were called dildos in those days, I think, from memory. All sort of quite detailed photographs of people in strange positions, and anything like that would have probably upset a mother, I would think. Mm-hmm. But anything that was considered to cause any form of offence or distress was just chucked away. Mm-hmm. And if he had any good clothes, they'd be offered for sale in the mess for a shilling or 1 and 2 pence or something. And any money collected went back to the parents. And once that was over, that was it.